This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. And one of the many things that Dr. Osmond works on is soldiers in the French army, particularly in the 17th century. So let's start off kind of broadly, Dr. Osmond. What's the view that even today a lot of scholars have of old regime French soldiers, kind of who they were, what their characteristics were, and how we write about them?
So I think kind of the general pervading impression that historians have of the early modern French soldier is that he was someone who was cold, miserable, downcast, undereducated, often desperate, inherently violent, and very separate from the rest of society.
Mm-hmm. And how have you found in your research that these impressions are incorrect?
I have found that, just like anything, if you tend to make broad statements about something, once you zero in on an individual, you find that that individual doesn't adhere to the broad statement. And so, of course, I'm finding that with French soldiers. I've been lucky enough to find a bunch of court cases for soldiers who deserted from their regiments in Franche-Comté in 1705. And so the way that the procès-verbal, the way that the court case is arranged, is that an officer is asking the soldier a question and the soldier has to respond, and then that response is recorded. And so it's about as close to soldiers describing themselves and explaining themselves in their own voice as I've been able to find. And so you get to know these individual soldiers as individuals, and then you find that, oh, well, they are free agents, or they play the system, or they decided to give the army a chance and decided they didn't like it very much, you know, or they come from various different backgrounds, or they joined the army full of optimism and hope and were actually quite happy. And it disrupts the kind of pervading impression that historians have propagated for the most part about the early modern French soldier.
Yeah, so one of the barriers we have, and you kind of discussed one of the ways over it, but one of the barriers we have is a good number of common people, including soldiers in the pre-modern period, are just simply illiterate. So records don't necessarily exist, and then you have the added burden of, even if they are illiterate, even if they did leave records, the records don't always survive, which is untrue in some ways of upper classes, where the records are more likely to survive and they're more likely to be made in the first place. So how have you circumvented these issues with the perpetuation of records to the present?
Sure. So it is true to a degree, and I mean, especially right now in kind of the broader history field, we're trying to get away from the archive. We're trying to get into kind of a post-archive way of gathering evidence about people who did not leave writing behind, because of course the vast majority of people in history did not leave writing behind in their own voice. And so we keep telling stories about the same kind of people over and over again, or writing history about the same kinds of people over and over again, and continuing to not talk about, you know, the huge swath of people who existed outside of the archive, or who at least don't have their voices represented in the archive. In terms of French soldiers, when you do read about French soldiers in the archive, you're almost always reading an officer's perspective or account of that soldier, or you're reading maybe an angry civilian's complaint about a soldier. And so, you know, you tend to collect stories of soldiers or kind of general references about soldiers as kind of fitting to the stereotype of being violent or nasty or hungry, underpaid, miserable creatures, always passive and always kind of under the will of their officers. Because the officers, when they write about soldiers, broadly speaking to each other, they just refer to soldiers in a very generic sense, like, I had to hang three soldiers today for desertion. And that's it. They don't even mention the soldiers' names. Mm-hmm. Or they might write like a big memo to the Council of War saying, oh, we need to do something about the problem of desertion in the army, and we need to do this with soldiers, or treat soldiers that way, or make sure we recruit soldiers in this way. So soldiers are always broad, never personalized in that sense. So what I've been looking for to try to understand soldiers better is, first of all, acknowledge, and this we already know, but I think we've been very lazy about as historians, is that, you know, there is no kind of generic soldier. So even from a pure military standpoint, when you talk about a French soldier, who are you talking about? Are you talking about a member of the French Line Army? Are you talking about a member of the militia or the milice? Are you talking about Swiss troops? Because mm-hmm. The Swiss was a particular element, a group of troops that have been kind of working with the French Line Army and doing very specific tasks for French defense for a while. Are you talking about the Maison Militaire, which was kind of the king's bodyguard made up of very high-ranking, high-status nobles? Are you talking about the Milice Bourgeoisie, which kind of refer to local defensives, like within a town? Things like that. So there are already multiple different kinds of service member or militaire, military person that you could be referring to when you just say the generic term soldier. So the one thing I think historians need to do is just a better job of acknowledging that. Mm-hmm. Second, in terms of finding sources or finding things in the archive that do allow soldiers to speak for themselves, is that one, I got just very lucky. I was using... I was pulling boxes from a series called A1 in the Vincennes Archive, which is the main archive for the French army in France, just outside of Paris, and I just happened upon a whole series of these desertion court cases. And because these desertion court cases are designed in kind of an interrogation response fashion, I get to hear, so to speak, or at least I get to read soldiers' responses almost as they are coming out of their own mouths. And so mm-hmm. that has been tremendously helpful, because in these interrogations of the soldiers, the officers are very thorough in establishing certain facts about the person on trial. So they will always ask, you know, how did you join the army? Did you join of your own free will? How much money were you paid? Who recruited you? Were you happy in your regiment? Were you paid regularly? Did you get enough bread? Did your captain treat you well? Did your sergeant treat you well? Why did you run away? Who found you? Where did you go? What were you thinking? Did you know that deserters were punished? So they always ask this series of questions, and it allows for a soldier to tell their individual recruitment story, how happy they were in the army, what their experience of service was like, etc. And so that's been very useful. But that's just one cache of documents from a specific region in 1 year. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I've been able to really comb through the campaign correspondence from this same series, this A1 series, to see what kind of stories officers are sharing with each other. And these are usually low-ranking officers. I usually can hardly even make out their names because their signatures are always very hard to read. But they're describing stories of just like, you know, strange things that their soldiers get into. And one example might be that, you know, there's a letter that I have that was written to a low-ranking officer by a member of the church saying that he was very sorry for punching a soldier in the face. But he punched the soldier in the face because he was walking his dog and the soldier passed by, picked up his dog, and tossed his dog into a pit. And the clergyman responded by punching the soldier in the face and now feels sorry about it. So I'll have a really interesting snippet of part of a story like that. Right. And then I have the joy as an historian of trying to figure out what happened. Why did the soldier pick up the guy's dog and throw it in a pit? What pit? Did the dog survive? I would have punched him too. And so I get to kind of think about that and try to put it in the context of, you know, where was this letter from? What was going on at the time? Was this when the army was on campaign? Were they wintering in a town and having issues with the locals? And that's where a lot of the good stories come out, is where there might be some kind of conflict between an individual soldier and the town members that they're garrisoning with.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think that's kind of a delicate part of doing this kind of study is, as you say, to not universalize the soldier. And a lot of people might be familiar with kind of the fraught works of somebody like an SLA Marshall or Dave Grossman, the idea that soldiering has always been soldiering. And if you know soldiers from one era, you know soldiers from another era. Or I work in an army institution. If you know Joe, you know Joe. Why do you think that's so incorrect to assume that Joe is Joe? And then how do you avoid universalizing?
Well, I have to say, and I have to admit, to be perfectly honest, that there have definitely been times when I've been reading about these various little stories or small anecdotes about soldiers, or I've been reading things that soldiers likely wrote. I do have a few letters that soldiers wrote, and I do have a few poems that I think soldiers wrote. I'm reading them, and I'm thinking, this could be a service member right now. Mm-hmm. And there have been times when I've presented at a conference, and say an Army captain comes up to me and says, these could be my guys today. Right. And I think that's just, I think that there's nothing wrong with identifying with people of the past. I think we inherently do that anyway, and it's part of what makes history fun. But I do think that we have to keep in mind at the same time that, the time and place in early modern France had its own specifics, and we would be doing a disservice to the people who had to live through that particular place and time to assume that it was just like ours and that they understood things the exact same way.
Right.
Whether it's in terms of the physical world, because the world of old regime France was much more visceral, much more physical, much harder on the senses than I think our world is. Also, they had different life expectancies, they had different spiritual understandings, they had different education levels, they had different priorities. And so you need to take, insofar as you can, you need to take each person on your own terms. And I think it's a bit, of a risk to kind of assume we might understand something when we don't, or to assume that maybe have a bit too much confidence in our own discoveries, our own principles, our own sciences, our own health discoveries, and thinking that, oh, we understand this now. Poor things, they didn't understand it back then. And then to take something from the present and impose it back in time. Because the people of the early modern era didn't think in 21st century American terms.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to try to understand the ways that they thought and the kind of world that they experienced. And I try to do that.
Yeah, so let's dive into some of the detail that you've talked about. First of all, with the paper you presented here about these court cases. So one of the points you made in it that I really liked was to give these men agency, to make them be more than just anonymous people in a uniform. So what did you learn about them and their agency from these cases?
So first, let me clarify that I did not give them any agency. They had the agency. I just got to read about it. And that is one of the things that surprised me when I was first reading through these court cases. And to be honest, like, each court case is handwritten in really bad handwriting, with very irregular spelling. And so each court case takes me several days to get through just to try to parse out what the letters are and what the words are, and then have to go back and actually try to figure out what's being said and then make meaning of it. It's a kind of a long, laborious process.
Mm-hmm.
But what surprised me when I was reading them was that some of the soldiers, not all of them, but some of the soldiers seemed to have a certain amount of professional pride in what they were doing. And according to the historiography, they're not supposed to have professional pride in what they're doing in 1705. In 1705,
right,
they're supposed to be miserable conscripts, kind of going with the stereotypes that's in the historiography. And so, because, again, we have this wonderful question and answer setup, you have things like the case of a soldier named Rencontre, who was 23 years old. He had joined the army willingly. He enjoyed being in his regiment. He was paid regularly. By his own testimony, he was happy with his lot. And then one day, a fellow soldier named Montagne said that he could make more money plying his trade with the Cologne army. And this is during the War of Spanish Succession. Cologne is involved in that war. It is not the French army. It's
mm-hmm.
in what we would think of today as Germany. And so Montagne and Rencontre came up with this wonderful plan of, going north to Liège, meeting up with some friends, getting some passports, going into Germany, and then being able to ply their trade for an army that would pay them more. And that struck me as very bold. And they started their plan. Rencontre and Montagne got as far as Luxembourg, where they sold their weapons to get money. And remember, these aren't really their weapons. They belong to the French army. But they sneak out, they sell their weapons, they have some money. Unfortunately for Rencontre, he's discovered in Luxembourg. He's taken back to his regiment, where he is tried. And I'm reading the trial. And during the trial, they ask him, like, were you mistreated in your regiment? Were you treated poorly by your sergeant? Were you not given enough to eat? And he says, no, I was very happy in my regiment. I was well treated. And you can kind of hear in the text, you can kind of hear this pause where the interrogators are kind of looking at each other and thinking, I mean, surely, you must not have known that soldiers who desert were punished. Did you know that soldiers who desert were punished? And he says, yes, no, I've been told many times that soldiers who desert are punished. And then they say, well, do you have anything else to say for yourself? And he just says, no. And they hang him that afternoon. Mm-hmm. And he's 23 years old. And whenever I've, you know, imparted this story to my colleagues, because it is so striking, you know, they've asked questions like, well, was he being tortured at the time? And I don't have evidence that he was being tortured at the time. Or, you know, they ask, well, was he covering for someone? Was he taking the fall to protect someone? And the only other person mentioned in the whole account is Montagne, so maybe. But again, he's not saying, I'm trying to protect my friend. So if I take him at his word, which is what I want to do with these soldiers, I mean, this is one of the rare occasions where they get to express themselves on their own terms. So I want to take them on their own terms and believe them when they tell me something. Mm-hmm. So if we take him on his own terms, no, it's just he is a free agent. He is a professional. He is plying his trade. He wants to go where he's going to get paid the most. It didn't work out for him, but he's owning his fate. Mm-hmm. He's not begging. He's not pleading. He's not coming up with excuses. He is owning his own fate, and he dies master of his own fate. And so you have to have, you know, a certain kind of response to that.
Mm-hmm. So you also mentioned that you've drawn sourcing from poems written by soldiers. So what have you found in those that has added to this kind of understanding of the soldiers?
So the poems that I found, and I have three, so I don't have a bunch, and there may be more. That's the thing. I think that we as historians have been so accepting of the idea that soldiers are just illiterate and that they could never have written anything and they could never have read anything, which I now know is very wrong, because I have all kinds of evidence that many soldiers were literate, probably certainly not all of them, but many soldiers were literate enough anyway, that I think that we've kind of trained ourselves not to see evidence of soldier literacy or soldier literature when we're presented with it. So this is something that I think everyone as historians, and there's so many sources to look for. There's no way that I as an individual could get it through over the course of my career. So I think we all need to just be more attuned to it. But the three poems that I do have come from the Mazarinades, which were a series of pamphlets that were published during the Fronde. And the Fronde is a French civil war from about 1648 to 1652. And all hell broke loose. And there were soldiers throughout Paris and soldiers wreaking havoc in other major metropolitan areas in France. And kind of in response to this horrible trauma that everybody was suffering, many people, regular, common, non-academic, non-high-status people, were writing their hearts out kind of in response to this trauma. And this writing was published almost entirely anonymously in these pamphlets called the Mazarinades. And I think at this point, archivists have compiled about 5,500 of them, so a fair number. Mm-hmm. So within these Mazarinades, I've searched through several indexes to try to isolate the ones that mentioned the violence of the day. Of those 5,500, there are about 450 that mention the violence of the day. And then of those 450 that talk about the violence, about five of them say they are written by soldiers. And so one of the ones that says it is written by a soldier is a soldier. It's a poem about a soldier who is having the night watch, and he's doing night watch, and he's thinking about how he used to be a civilian and life was better back then. And this is how I know it was written by a soldier, because it says, ah, I am on the night watch. And I am a soldier, and my life is kind of sad. And the poem recounts that, you know, back when he was a civilian, he worked at his anvil all day, and then at night he'd sleep in a nice feather bed, and on Sundays he'd play dice with his friends, and he had plenty to eat. But now he is a soldier, and he eats black bread, and he has the night watch instead of being in his feather bed, and he perpetuates all kinds of bad things, and he even beats his civilian host and his wife. And he kind of reflects on, oh, becoming a soldier has made me a worse person. You know, maybe someday I can go back. And so this kind of poem tells you a lot of things. You know, one, it tells you that, you know, soldiers, or at least this particular individual, I don't want to apply his experience to everybody, but this particular individual was, you know, aware of the kind of suffering that his profession caused other people. He regretted his civilian life. He clearly did not want to be doing what he was doing. And it also tells me that this barrier between civilian and soldier, which is another stereotype that I think historians have, and one that I have perpetuated in my first book, that this barrier between soldier and civilian is much more porous than we thought it was. And so historians like to talk about how once a soldier became a soldier, he was completely separate from the peasantry. And this seems to make sense because we know that there are many times when soldiers would pillage and they would prey on the peasantry, and they would, maybe for reasons of military expediency, they would have to burn homes and, you know, kill civilians and things like that. But I don't know that those cases are necessarily representative of the entire soldier-civilian relationship, because you have things like the militia, or the bourgeoisie militia, or you have plenty of civilians who, in times of duress, were pressed into the army and then want to rejoin the civilian life as soon as they can. Or I have in my desertion cases civilians who decided to join the army and a few days in decided it was not for them and went back to their hometown. So here I have a poem, you know, written from the perspective of a soldier saying that he misses his civilian life. I also have another poem written by a soldier where it's incredibly sad. And the poem says, you know, I am a soldier. I woke up one morning and it was a beautiful day, and I decided to go on walkabout and just take a risk and see if I could skitter away without my regiment noticing me. And then the soldier, as he's walking around, he interacts with soldiers of the line army who are eating disgusting soup with pig fat in it and are acting as though it's a wonderful meal because they're so hungry. He runs into those Swiss troops who are dining on fine pheasant because they are paid better. And he runs into a buddy of his in a regiment, and his buddy is so depressed and terrified because he knows he's going to have to go fight soon and he's anticipating being killed. And then the soldier goes back to his regiment and hopefully sneaks in unawares. I assume that he survives and is fine because he lives to write this poem. But even if the poem is not a literal description of a soldier's day, it's allowing a soldier to kind of discuss the things they see and discuss the things they run into and what this particular person is thinking about and reflecting on. And the fear of death is very present in that poem.
Yeah. So one of the things that we've talked about with people like Dr. Alexander Burns, same time period, soldiers from different militaries, in particular Prussian and English, is the ubiquity of religion in those soldiers' accounts. Do you find the same thing in these, whether they're largely French Protestant soldiers or maybe French Catholic or Swiss Protestant soldiers? Do you find the same sense of religion and the ubiquity of faith in these accounts?
I haven't yet, and which doesn't mean it's not there. I have of the campaign correspondence, that 1A series, the A1 series I've been talking about. Again, I'm looking at about 12% of what I know exists. So there's lots more work to be done if you're looking for a project. So far, I have not seen many references to religion in those texts. In the desertion court cases, they always begin with the person bearing witness or the person giving testimony, you know, giving their name, their age, their religion, and then taking an oath in which they swear to tell the truth. And so most of the time that religion is Catholic. Sometimes I've run across maybe two or three cases at this point where the religion is Protestant. But that's the only mention made so far. The only other reference I have to religion at this point is that I know there were chaplains who traveled with the army or sometimes were found in hospitals. And I only know this because I have a letter from a chaplain who was writing on behalf of a very young soldier who was sick, who was trying to write home to his mother and explain that he was captured and kidnapped into service, which is very bad. You're not supposed to do that. That now he's sick in the hospital and he wants money. And so because the letter begins with, "Dear Madam, hello, I am a chaplain and writing this letter."
Right.
That's how I know that. But I haven't found religion being a huge part of soldier discourse yet.
Interesting. One of the other very interesting things I found in particularly the research you presented this year was this idea of a nom de guerre.
Oh,
that the soldier takes
this
on a name,
yes,
that's different from their baptismal name.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the tradition of that, and what do you think it means?
So this is one of those things where I think people are identifying things that link soldiers then with soldiers now. Because, you know, if you've seen Top Gun, you know that some military members still have call signs, and that those call signs are very important to them and a huge part of their identity, and they often still prefer to go by those call signs. And you can find other cultures where there are, like, given names and things like that. So I find, though, that, first of all, every soldier I've come across so far has a nom de guerre, and that nom de guerre, that soldier name, is the name they prefer to go by. And the name is usually somehow descriptive. So one of the main soldiers that I talk about in the paper is Joli Bois, which means beautiful wood. Mm-hmm. And it's also a very common last name in France now. Mm-hmm. Other soldier names that I've come across, prêt à boire, which means ready to drink. Or sang-froid, which literally means cold blood, but it means that you are brave in the face of violence or scary things happening to you. You know, you have your sang-froid. Another name, probably my favorite, is sauve les meubles, which means save the furniture. Although one person said that might be a French idiom for being friendly or happy. When I first saw that nom de guerre, I thought that maybe it meant that this person had a side business and used furniture, and so whenever they pillaged something, he'd shout out, save the furniture, because he was planning to use it to make money or something like that. So obviously I'm having a lot of interpretation or opportunities for interpretation when I look at these nom de guerre. And it's one of the things that I'm trying to understand better is exactly where these names came from. So I'm curious if there was maybe some kind of minor or casual ritual when a civilian became a soldier or when an inhabitant entered the army, and if he was kind of christened with this new name by his fellow soldiers. And I always think of the not to be presentist, and this is what we have to be mindful of. But I always think of that scene in Animal House when you know, they're the new members of, you know, the Delta fraternity, and John Belushi is pouring beer on them and saying, "You are Mothball and you're Pinto." So, because they're those kinds of names.
Right.
So I always kind of wonder, was it something like that? Did the soldier choose his own new name? You know, was there a time of, did you have to go out into the woods naked and then come back and the name would be revealed to you? And I have not come across at all what the process was or what the rituals were involved in this name. Only that these names were important because whenever there's any official accounting of the soldier, they always give the soldier's baptismal name or Christian name, followed by whatever his nom de guerre is, whatever his soldier name is. And I do have a memoir, which is like a memo that an officer wrote to the Council of War suggesting improvements for the army, in which he says, you know, officers' relationships with the soldiers would be better if the officers used their Christian names or their baptismal names rather than their soldier names. So apparently the officers would use these nom de guerre to refer to their soldiers as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping to kind of look at, even if I can't find reference to exactly how this name was assigned to a soldier, I am hoping to kind of collect these names. I'm always very careful to take note of them. I want to collect as many names as I can, and then even have maybe a chapter where I kind of take apart the names and look at which ones were most common that I've been able to find, you know, what they meant, if I find that certain names appear most often in certain years, you know, things like that. Another name that I come across was like sans merci, which means no mercy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so some of these sound like very fierce, like fierce names. Some of these sound like very jolly names. Some of them are very descriptive names. And then some are very Catholic names. So
right.
You have people who have names like Saint Francis, which is Saint Francis, or Saint Pierre, Saint Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And the saint element is also is part of that nom de guerre. So sometimes you have these Catholic names. So I'd like to spend some more time kind of unpacking what those might mean.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It sounds like some exciting new directions in the studies of French soldiers. Dr. Osmond, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Hello, I'm here with Dr. Alexander Burns from Franciscan University at Steubenville. Dr. Burns, welcome.
Thanks so much, Abel. It's great to be here.
So one of the things that, Dr. Burns, you involve yourself a lot in is kind of non-academic history pursuits, whether kind of on the hobby side or on the more serious research type side. And in particular, three related but probably distinct fields, video gaming, wargaming or board gaming, and reenacting or living history. So first of all, kind of conceptually, listeners are well familiar with the academic process of history, going to archives, reading secondary works, putting those together with archival and primary sources into books and articles and those kinds of things. These non-academic and perhaps non-traditional methods of history, what do you think in general that they add to the field?
Sure, that's a really good question. So I guess I would say they each add something different, and it's important, at least in my mind, not to be too positivist in our claims about what they add. I mean, certainly they're hobbies. They think they're things we do for enjoyment. They can inform our thinking, maybe even should inform our thinking. But I'm not someone who looks at reenactments and says, wow, this is like experimental archaeology. I know what it was like to be an 18th century soldier because I've been a reenactor. I don't think that's a helpful framework necessarily. Now, with that said, start with reenacting and then move into the gaming of the various types, whether video or on the tabletop. With reenacting, what it can instruct you as a professional historian, as someone who just has an interest in history, what you're really getting, if you're doing it well, is a greater appreciation for the world of the material culture. In our period, that's the material culture of the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
So how these uniforms are constructed, what materials they're constructed from, maybe even some of the symbolism that goes into creating these armies that we often see in, you know, oil paintings and things like this, you gain more of an appreciation, again, maybe not for the reality of the past, but for the limitations of the equipment and the technology that these soldiers were equipped with. So it is a way for you to, in conjunction with written sources, primary sources, from officers, from soldiers, to place yourself maybe in the mental space, not of these soldiers themselves, but an approximation of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I mean, in this way, I think a natural ally of professional academic historians are people who work in living history or historic interpretation. I think of people like Matt Cagle up at Fort Ticonderoga, and essentially he's a uniformologist, right? I mean, he's working not only about the detailed reality of, say, how you construct an 18th century grenadier cap,
right,
but also what that symbolized, what it meant, with the significance of these items for the states and the armies that employed them. And so I do think that an understanding of material culture can also inform things like strategy or even operations. I mean, if you look at the transition in the Prussian army, say, in the 1750s, from linen to wool gamaschen or gaiters, like the lower leg wear these soldiers wore,
mm-hmm.
It comes about because of the operational realities. Frederick loses most of Silesia, which is where the linen center in his, like the linen manufacturing center is in his state. And so as a result, the army switches to wool because they don't have as much access to high-quality linen anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so material culture, again, being a reenactor does not immediately give you like some sort of magic insight into the past.
Right.
I think that's a fallacy, obviously. But I do think it's one part of the overall process of trying to as a historian, develop empathy for the peoples of the past.
Mm-hmm.
There are many stories we disagree. My undergraduate advisor, a wonderful man named David K. Burden, repeatedly argued that reenactors essentially are destroying our understanding of the past, that they're a threat to the past, they're misleading the public. And I think the truth is somewhere between there and it's a magic bullet for, you know, reconstructing the past.
Right.
So I think if you use it responsibly in a constructive way that's highly rigorous, and there are groups out there who, I mean, this is like their life, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they are dedicated to reproducing these garments, these pieces of equipment with period techniques.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go as far as to say it can be helpful in sort of your academic writing. I mean, in my book that's coming out in August, I do acknowledge some reenactors who I think have helped me frame problems in the book, for example. But again, if especially as 18th century historians who are often trying to reconstruct a world with imperfect written sources, mm-hmm. this is maybe an additional tool that the historian can grab out of their toolkit to try and develop a greater historical empathy and maybe even an understanding of the past.
Mm-hmm. So let's dive more deeply into this. You've mentioned a few terms that I think it's helpful to parse. Living history, reenactment, mm-hmm. I'll throw antiquarian in there,
sure.
Which is a term that certainly belongs to the past. Experimental archaeology, you also mentioned.
Yeah.
So what are the effective differences between these different fields or approaches?
Absolutely. So I would say, at its most basic level, reenacting traditionally has meant from the 1960s and 70s to the present day in America and now broadly in the Western world, dressing up in military uniforms and participating in mock battles. Mm-hmm. And if you look at like the photos and videos coming out, you know, or that were taken in the 60s and 70s, sometimes these people were, you know, reenacting the American Civil War wearing blue jeans, right? I mean, there is certainly a sliding scale of quality.
Right.
In many reenactment groups in the United States today, we haven't advanced much further beyond that in terms of seriously engaging with the past in the material culture. I mean, yes, you might wear a uniform that looks something like an 18th century uniform, but it's essentially a form of cosplaying, mm-hmm. as opposed to going through the process of trying to meticulously, reconstruct these garments using period techniques. Living history, or what some might call hardcore or progressive reenacting, is more about trying to recreate the details of the life of the soldier, not for the public perspective, which is often the view of reenactments. We're going to have a mock battle and 100,000 people can come and buy a ticket and watch it.
Right.
Okay. So living history, hardcore reenacting, progressive reenacting, again, all of these are terms that sometimes I view interchangeably. This is more about what it can teach you. Going out and doing an 18-mile march in straight last shoes constructed by period techniques. How does that inform you? What do your feet feel like at the end of that process?
Right.
What does it feel like to eat period rations constructed with period recipes? So my wife and I do volunteer work at the Frontier Culture Museum in Stanton, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredible experience. One, you're informing the public because it's an open-air museum. Two, you're informing yourself. You're in a house that was literally constructed in the 1680s in the Rhineland. You're cooking using period techniques from period recipes from the middle of the 18th century. Are you recreating the past? No. But you are trying to get closer, maybe in an imperfect way, of putting yourself in the mental world or at least the physical world of people who lived, in that case, in like a civilian world in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that's another key difference. Reenacting is essentially about trying to, maybe in a positive and effective way, maybe not, recreate the military formations of these periods. Whereas hardcore reenacting, progressive reenacting, you often find civilian people who engage in living history. You often find, as opposed to trying to kind of shambolically recreate a miniature version of a 18th century standing army, you have, say in the case of the American Civil War, really dedicated individuals like the Liberty Rifles who would try to create one unit at a specific place in time, trying to recreate a specific company of this unit,
yeah.
sort of going through the same processes that unit did, say, in approaching the battlefield, or what they ate, based on what we can know from written sources. Beyond this, we have the realm of things like historic interpretation. These are people who are professionals, in the same way that we are professional historians, mm-hmm. people like Matt Cagle, Davis Tierney at the Frontier Culture Museum. They're professionals in interpreting the past for the public. And they have maybe a slightly different but related set of goals as we do as historians, trying to bring the past to people's minds, trying to, you know, sort of make the past tangible and graspable. One of the things that I often struggle with as a professional academic historian, if you look at Samuel Tilden's Principles of Interpretation, he argues one of the main goals of the interpreter is to provoke, so not just to engage in reconstructing the past, but do so in a way that is almost provocative, or it really leaves the person touring this open-air museum with a lot of questions.
Kind of an affective approach.
Yeah, absolutely. And then last, and I want to be careful because I don't want to get death threats from reenactors, but like maybe least is this concept of experimental archaeology, the idea that we can know what it was like to be in an ancient Greek hoplite clash by trying to simulate this in the modern world.
I think the person who has done a lot of this visibly over the last 20 years is probably Ruth Goodman.
Sure.
She makes these experimental archaeology shows.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say, I watch and enjoy those shows, right?
Oh, yeah.
My wife and I are watching Tudor Monastery Farm right now.
Right, if I find one, I definitely watch it too.
Yeah, I mean, the people who go into making television programs like this often do have formal training, perhaps as historians, perhaps as archaeologists.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, so often when we go to conferences like the one we're at now, the Consortium of the Revolutionary Era, and we talk to academic historians, people who are trying to grapple with the past are very eager to put themselves into silos and say, we don't want to really think about this. And, you know, we're academic historians. We write papers. Those people who dress up are a lot.
And vice versa, the people who dress up would say only writing papers is sterile.
Absolutely. And so I think, again, and there's no magic solution here, there's no lesson, but I think that trying to have you, at least if not your foot, maybe your toe in a couple of these worlds can make you a little bit more well-rounded. It can bring questions to your mind that, being an academic historian, maybe it makes you a better progressive reenactor. Being a progressive reenactor, perhaps, depending on your topic, depending on the type of reenacting you do, maybe it can bring up questions in your mind that you tackle in the academic world. And so just trying to, I think, silo these groups out and say, never shall the two meet, is not helpful. So at the panel that we just came from, Abel, afterwards, a couple people were discussing wargaming at mm-hmm. academic conferences. And these are two historians who are military adjacent or social military historians, and they were essentially saying, man, what a weird academic conference that people play war games here. Like how nuts is this?
Right.
And absolutely, you know, it can be easy for professional academic historians, maybe in a way that smacks of, I don't want to say elitism or snobbery, but the seriousness of our work can look down on people who try to engage with the past in more popular ways. I mean, by the same token, and I'm guilty of this, I wrote a long thread hating on Ridley Scott on Twitter, there are two panels at this conference evaluating the Napoleon movie that came out last year, right? And so, in some ways, we seem to pick and choose as professionals. It's acceptable to, you know, watch Napoleon and you know, evaluate this movie from a historical standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Is it acceptable to wargame? Is it acceptable to reenact? Sometimes I wonder, you know, are these categories fairly artificial?
Yeah, no, and that's a good transition into talking about. I think we have well established, both on this podcast and more broadly, the value of wargaming. I teach at a professional military education institution. We have a wargaming department, and you are a committed wargamer as well. So, kind of briefly, what do you see as the value of wargaming?
Absolutely. So if the value of reenacting or living history or whatever you want to call it is trying to put yourself in the milieu or the area of these individuals,
mm-hmm.
the value of maybe not wargaming itself, but trying to construct a model by which you wargame allows you to maybe more fully grapple with the operational side of history. I mean, if living history is trying to predominantly answer more social history questions, I think wargaming is primarily interested in operational and tactical and you know, to some extent, strategic questions. Mm-hmm. And so for the perspective of the military historian, again, I sure hope no academic historian will play a war game of the Battle of Waterloo and think, man, I know what it was like now. This is all I need to do.
Right.
I'm very wary of kind of positivist claims that this should inform us, this experiential thing should inform us more than the written word. I'm an academic historian.
Right.
It's my bias. But with that said, I do think if you're going to engage with military history in a way that we might call guns and trumpets or operational history or tactical history, wargaming can do what reenacting does for the social historian for this, you know, old military history practitioner or whatever the right or
right.
politically correct thing they call it these days is, right?
Right? So the value that I think we find, and I'm going to steal a quote from my colleague, Dr. James Sterrett, is, as you say, the war game doesn't allow you to walk a mile in the shoes mm-hmm. of the people playing, but it does allow you to walk a step or two in their socks. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that we really value war games for is the decision-making process under stress. Now, obviously, it's not combat stress, but the time and scenario pressure enables people to understand how you make decisions and given a certain amount of information. And I think that's really valuable. Now, as we said, war games are ubiquitous now in professional military education, in militaries, in Congress. There are reports that come out of Congress every week about aides and Congress people playing war games. But by and large, these are physical war games or physical war games maybe with a computer assist. Mm. I think the bridge we have not yet crossed, because everything we've talked about so far, there is an element of academia too. Mm-hmm. The bridge that we have not yet crossed is video games. Mm. Despite the ubiquity of history set video games, whether they're first person type games like Kingdom Come Deliverance, which mm-hmm. aspires to be historically accurate, or in particular the strategy or 4X type games like the Total War series, the games that Paradox makes, mm-hmm. Like Europa Universalis or Crusader Kings. So first of all, why do you think video games are seen differently from physical board games or reenacting or whatever?
Sure, that's a really good question. I guess I would say I don't necessarily view them terribly differently. I think one is the physical war game, the board game, the tabletop war game is doing something in a physical in a relational space, mm-hmm. And to some extent the digital video war game is trying to allow that same experience to be facilitated over distance or even solo by yourself. Now
right.
there are solo physical board games or war games that you can play. To some extent, this in how they're viewed differently, this may be a cultural bias. Mm-hmm. I come from a relatively conservative social background in terms of my upbringing, coming out of the homeschool movement, and you heard a lot of anti-video game rhetoric growing up. Like, it makes young men lazy. They just want to spend all day playing video games in their basement. You know, this is no way to raise a generation of serious thinkers. And so, I think it's important to, much as we might say not all reenacting is helpful, not all tabletop wargaming is helpful in instructing strategic thought or operational thought, making people react in a limited amount of time and maybe a slightly stressful way to the issue of decision making. In video games, I'm not sure that playing Call of Duty is going to make you a better infantryman, right? In fact, maybe in some ways it might not.
Right. You don't respawn.
Exactly right. But at the same time, video games that attempt to some extent, recreate the operational problems of wargaming writ large that we've seen from the develop historically from like the middle of the 18th century on, mm-hmm. The first English language military war game that I'm familiar with is an officer's pamphlet that comes from 1760 in Britain, where essentially this lieutenant colonel outlines how you would run a tabletop exercise for the officers of the battalion.
Mm-hmm.
He goes into things like, what are the movement rates, you know, for the platoon of soldiers that you're commanding? How do you deploy the regiment from, you know, column of platoons into line of battle? These are things that, in a tabletop wargaming setting, in a tactical or operational video game setting, I can see a lot of continuity there between the 1760s
mm-hmm.
and sort of what we're doing either in a physical or a digital space today. By and large, wargamers, although Games Workshop, the people who make Warhammer 40K, the popular science fiction tabletop game, right. have done a lot to try and change this. Tabletop wargaming is still viewed as more of a niche hobby, even if people like Henry Cavill are engaged in it.
Mm-hmm.
So
real quick, so people understand, when we say tabletop gaming, we're talking about gaming with lots of miniatures, mm-hmm. physical miniatures that are usually gorgeously hand-painted, mm-hmm. using lots of man-hours.
Absolutely. And so this process is, to some extent, there's a much higher sunk cost than there is in video gaming, where you buy when I was growing up, like a $30 video game, now a $70 video game, that you then don't have to paint the figures, you don't have to, you know, set up the scenario, you don't have to buy the terrain or paint little houses or trees. You can just put on the computer and ponder a operational and tactical problem.
Right.
And so I think to some extent the reason why we have a cultural reaction maybe against video games and not against tabletop exercises is that, one, video games have gone mainstream, maybe in a way that physical wargaming has yet to do.
Yeah.
And two, I do think there might be some institutional bias. I mean, you can trace the roots of tabletop wargaming exercise to the middle of the 18th century, or, you know, if you want to be very, very strict, like the Kriegspiel exercise the Prussians do in the early 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas video games are something that, you know, only come about in the last, maybe some video game people will say I'm mischaracterizing, but since like 1990 or just before 1990.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out too, the ones that try some element of historical accuracy, those are late 90s at best,
yeah.
simply because the graphics and processing capabilities required for them are higher, particularly above the kind of petty tactical level of something like Call of Duty.
Yeah.
So, given that there is this divide, and it's worth pointing out, one of the reasons that the gaming folks that I work with don't use a lot of virtual stuff is high barrier to entry, you got to have the physical equipment, and there are very few good war games, digital war games, that don't require a massive time investment to understand. You know, the joke about Paradox Games is the first 1,000 hours of the tutorial.
Yeah.
So how do you think that gap might be bridged to bring digital gaming to the place where physical wargaming is as a useful tool?
Sure. So I guess I would say, I'm not sure that it's not a useful tool now. Second, I do think to some extent it's just going to be an issue of time. I've been teaching in higher education at the college level since 2013,
mm-hmm.
And I in most of my upper level classes during that time, I've used either some sort of physical, not always war games. I mean, sometimes it's like a social simulation,
right?
Either digitally or physically, and the benefits that you describe with tabletop or physical wargaming, those, by and large, transfer over into the digital space. You're giving students a set amount of time. In the case of things like the Reacting to the Past games, it enables you to again, have students seriously think about this. There are consequences, right? I mean, in all the games I run, the winning team will get a slight percentage of extra credit on the midterm or the final exam. And so there are very soft, real-world consequences for the failure.
Right.
And so there's a bit of, you know, an edge of, hey, maybe I should really, try and be invested in this simulation. It develops historical empathy. It allows you to see the challenges and the parameters. I mean, one of the problems that, whether we're talking about large professional military tabletop exercises or, you know, in a civilian academic class, is students often want to do something different than what's in the simulation. They want to answer the problem in a different way, and what you're trying to do is get them to see sort of within the framework and the possibilities of the past, what was possible. It's a way to, I don't love this term, but a way to live the past forward as opposed to looking at the past in hindsight.
Right.
I guess I would also say that whether we like it or not, and, you know, again, I'm not trying to say that you probably shouldn't play Call of Duty to learn to be an infantryman. As a way of engaging with the past, sometimes in class, I will literally describe a very complex early modern historical phenomena in terms of a paradox game.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll explain what I mean in non-video game terms, but there is a subset of student where instantly that clicks.
Right.
And so, for example, in my history of Eastern Europe class at Franciscan this semester, we were talking about essentially the reductions in Sweden in the 1680s and earlier in the 17th century. And I looked at my student Paul, who I know is a huge EU4 guy, and I said, "Paul, what are they doing here? Describe this process for us." And he says, "Well, they're interacting with the estates panel and they're clicking the seize land from the nobility button." And so in games like EU4, I mean, jokingly say you're playing a spreadsheet, right? I mean, it's a huge and complex game, but a game of that complexity also allows you to represent, maybe in EU4, not things on the tactical level in a really granular way, but it's almost like a society simulator.
And to play on that, I think the value of a paradox type game is, and for people who aren't familiar, these are games that are immersive, they're based in history, and they last centuries.
Yeah.
So the choices that your student is making in dealing with the estates of his realm may have repercussions 100 years down the line in the game.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that I think video games can do better than physical games, because physical games generally require physical presence. And even, you know, the most hardcore physical gamer can only play them for you know, 8, 10, 12 hours at a time. Whereas with a video game, you can turn it on and off, and you could truly see the consequences of strategic decision making.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, this has been a fascinating discussion. Dr. Burns, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me on here.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.